From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Irma has been downgraded to a tropical storm, but the threat is not over for millions of people who've been and still are in her path. More than 6 million homes and businesses in Florida are without power. And today, the National Weather Service said the late morning storm surge flooding downtown Jacksonville, all the way up in the northeast corner of Florida, broke an all-time record. Let's start our check-in with NPR's Camilla Domonowski on Naples Beach, down on the southwest coast. Camilla, Naples is low-lying. A lot of people didn't realize the storm might veer over to the west where Naples is. There was a lot of fear at the last minute. But it feels as if Naples, while bruised, was not bowed.
Yeah, what people were extremely worried about here was the possibility of a completely devastating storm surge. So the National Hurricane Center had been warning of 10 to 15 feet of storm surge. You add on top of that the heavy rains and the waves, and people were extremely worried about horrifying flooding. And that didn't happen. You know, we're here now, we're at the beach, it's not washed away. There was a storm surge. I talked to people who reported a foot, 3 feet. There was one tire gauge in the area that saw a 7 foot rise over the course of less than 2 hours. But in general, it wasn't that 15 feet horror show that people had been really worried about. That doesn't mean that everyone got away scot-free. Power is out here. The phones are out. Water was out for a lot of people. Utilities are down. And many of the roads are blocked with fallen trees.
Well, one of the things people love about Naples, especially the old part, is that a lot of the old structures were kept. And these are more like cottages than the big modern homes that are being built. So there was concern about those. But what is the sense of when electricity might come back, when it might start righting itself, and when people can come from shelters because the shelters were packed?
The shelters were packed. And at this point, you know, they're still advising people to stay off the roads, let rescue workers, let the local authorities investigate the situation, see when it's going to be safe. I was up in Fort Myers earlier today where there's a shelter there that was housing a lot of people who were evacuating from right on the coast, coming into a safer point a little further inland. And in the parking lot outside of the shelter, I talked to Stephen Ward. He's a 77-year-old resident of Fort Myers who had arrived at the shelter early on Friday to make sure that he got a spot.
There was between 5,000 and 6,000 people here. 500 of them had serious problems of one kind or another. There was another 300 or 400 that were just totally out of control. There was nothing you could do. What are you going to do? Are you going to push them out the door? So there was just very little coordination here.
He said that the volunteers at the shelter and the National Guard there did everything they could, but there were a lot of people. The roof sprang a leak. And then one major concern was that now it's Monday morning. People have been there all weekend. They want to go home and see what their houses look like. And the sheriff's office hasn't said that it's okay for people to travel on the roads yet. The National Guard is letting people go, telling them that they do it at their own risk. And some people's cars have gotten stuck trying to get out of the shelter and onto the main roads because there's water standing on lots of these smaller roads.
Boy, I tell you, with all of the coverage, all of the media coverage, it was 24/7. It's still so unpredictable. You know, you can leave a shelter and get stuck. And it also sounds like you can't really gauge from one place, you know, where you're standing in Naples, how another place has fared.
Oh, absolutely. The impact of the flooding is so localized. It depends on exactly where a storm surge hit and what the geography of that particular region is, how sturdy a building is when the winds hit it. The amount of damage that was caused by the storm really is very variable.
And now, did you say that Naples was without power?
Yeah. I mean, I'm talking to people. I've talked to people on the beach who have no power, no phone lines, didn't have any water after the storm hit. And, you know, they see the NPR shirt and they're like, hey, what's the news? We haven't had any connection to the outside world. A lot of people are very concerned about reaching friends and family to let them know that it was okay, that it wasn't as bad as they had feared, and they don't have phones and can't call out.
Well, and that's still pretty tough. If you have to get an entire state's power back on, you're talking about refrigerators that aren't working, food that's not keeping, children's bottles that are not being, you know, heated up. It's there's a challenge ahead.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. NPR's Camilla Domonowski in Naples, Florida. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Robin.
So where is Irma now? Well, Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Jeremy.
And what is the latest on the storm?
Well, it's crossing the Florida-Georgia border now as a weakening tropical storm. It's heading to the northwest into parts of Alabama. It will eventually become extratropical in the next couple of days and kind of stall over the Tennessee River Valley.
Are places like Tallahassee still in trouble with this storm?
Just some final rain bands rolling through. Tallahassee definitely was spared the worst of this to the east, but still some rain bands rotating through. And we'll have this flow from the southwest across the entire state of Florida. So conditions will be much better, of course, in the coming days. But there will still be some pretty good rain bands and some afternoon showers and thunderstorms with this flow off the Gulf of Mexico.
And what about Jacksonville?
Well, ironically enough, hundreds of miles from where Irma came ashore, we have record-breaking storm surge in Jacksonville. As the wind turns to the south today, it's pushing all the water that moved into the St. Johns River back to the north because the wind is now out of the south-southwest, and record storm surge is occurring on the northern sides of the St. Johns River. So there's been some extra evacuations taking place this morning in that city.
One of the things we noticed over the weekend and yesterday was that when the storm surge, when we were waiting for the storm surge in some places, we saw the water go out in other places. Was that expected? Does that happen in every storm?
It's hard to predict that locally, especially. It does not happen in every storm. It has to do with the way the storm moves in across the coast and the angle at which it approaches. There are so many things that make this storm unique, and that was certainly one of them.
What were the others?
Well, first of all, from a meteorological standpoint, so many records broken. I think the biggest thing I saw this morning, which was obtained from Colorado State, Dr. Phil Klotschbach has posted some information on Irma, and there was more what we call accumulated cyclone energy. It's a measure of several things, not just the wind speeds. It's the storm duration, how long it's over water. There was more what we call ACE accumulated by this storm than what is normal for an entire hurricane season in the Atlantic. And no other Atlantic storm has accumulated more ACE than Irma. So, of course, Florida took a direct hit from this, but we have to remember how long lived and how long this storm was a Category 5 over the Atlantic, which also broke records.
When you look at the state of Florida today, where does it look like the worst of the damage is?
Well, that's a difficult question. And I was speaking last night to our Florida Public Radio Emergency Network partners about how as we were starting to see this thing wind down, we were starting to provide some context to it. It was certainly a bad storm and one that's going to take weeks, if not months, to recover from in southwest Florida. But I think maybe what makes this unique and what I'm going to personally remember it for is when you think of damage and impact on a scale, I'm not sure this was at the very top of the scale because of the way it took a more further inland track. But Jeremy, the mid-level, the level 3, level 4 type damage was widespread across Florida. I mean, every county has power outages and trees down and, dealing with an aftermath that's going to also last for days, if not weeks.
Well, what does it tell you that, we've been talking to people in the Keys today, in Marco Island, in Naples, and it does sound like they all feel like it could have been a lot worse. What does it tell you that it isn't a lot worse?
Well, it absolutely should remind you that the worst can happen. We were posting a Facebook Live video 2 days before landfall, alerting our Southwest Florida listeners and Facebook viewers that the worst was at play for Tampa Bay. The worst was at play for Fort Myers. If this thing would have stayed offshore a few miles and moved up the coast and kind of paralleled the coast, you're looking at a worst-case scenario in terms of storm surge for both of those metro areas. Thankfully, that did not happen, but we should be reminded that this can happen, and we are just lucky that it didn't. But still, our heart goes out to everyone who did experience a significant impact from Irma.
Because the power is out in a lot of Florida and because communication lines are not working as well as they usually do, a lot of people have no idea what's going on either where they live or in the towns nearby. I don't know whether they can get on the road and start driving somewhere or if the roads are closed. What's ahead now for Florida as people start to make their way back home?
Well, first, I would say to all those people, you're not alone. The entire state, maybe minus locations west of Panama City, are experiencing some type of inconvenience at the very least from this storm. So you're not alone. We're all going to get through this together. It's going to take a while. But moving forward, I don't see any significant weather events that potentially could impact the state, at least in the next week. We are watching Jose out in the Atlantic, but that is now forecast to stay out to sea. But just remember, we have only really reached the peak of hurricane season, which was yesterday, and we still need to keep a wary eye onto developing systems in the Atlantic. Thankfully, though, I don't see any. in the next 7 to 10 days.
I did see one tweet over the weekend, however, that showed Jose in one of the forecast tracks, one of the many, going up to the northeast and hitting in the northeast in a week or so. Is that a real possibility, or you think it'll stay out to sea?
Right now, I'm believing it will stay out to sea, but it is going to come close enough that everyone from the Mid-Atlantic states to New England still needs to watch this closely. Jose is a little bit lost right now at sea. It's wandering around aimlessly without any general strong direction. We'll keep a close eye on it, but right now, officially, I don't believe it's going to have a direct impact. But it's that time of year. These things can make some turns and do whatever they want sometimes.
That's Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, keeping us all informed over the last week. Jeff, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jeremy.
We're watching Irma today, but we're also marking the 16th anniversary of the September 11th attacks.
Gerard Batiste.
Walter Barron.
Gerard A. Barbera.
Paul Vincent
in
Barbaro.
New York today, the reading James of the William names Barbaro. Of those who died. Victor One of them was a
Daniel
man who rescued
Barbosa.
People in the World Trade Center. Then President Obama talked about him at the dedication of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum in 2014.
They didn't know his name. They didn't know where he came from. But they knew their lives had been saved by the man in the red bandana.
The man in the red bandana was Wells Crowther. ESPN correspondent Tom Rinaldi told his story in the book The Red Bandana, A Life, A Choice, A Legacy. I spoke with Rinaldi last September and started by asking him to introduce us to Wells Crowther.
In a lot of ways, I think Wells was a very well-accomplished young man, but not a superstar. And it took a day that's indelible in the history of our country for Wells to make his imprint on this country and build his legacy. He's from Upper Nyack, New York, in the Hudson River Valley. Grew up there, was a wonderful athlete and honor student, went to Boston College, played Division I sports there as a lacrosse player, but was also a volunteer firefighter growing up. Idolized his father, Jefferson, and followed him into the Empire Hook and Ladder Company No. 1 ranks. And was that rare mix of athlete and firefighter through high school, graduated from Boston College, took a job in finance on Wall Street, and on 9/11/01, Jeremy was on the 104th floor of the South Tower.
And we'll get into what happened there because it is pretty incredible. But going back to the fact that he was a volunteer firefighter, you describe he and his father even fighting a fire at the home of novelist Toni Morrison on one Christmas day.
Isn't that remarkable?
It's unbelievable.
It's incredible how lives intersect and storylines do as well. Not only did they fight a fire together, Jeremy, Wells' very first fire call came on a Christmas morning, as you note. The first call that they get together, Wells is so anxious, he's screaming up to his father upstairs in the house, "Let's go, Dad, let's go, Dad." Ultimately, they get there. And for all the training he's gone through as a junior firefighter, now they get separated. And it was a massive fire in which Morrison's house was gutted. However, the works of an American master were in a protective safe in the house, and so she lost nothing. But that was ultimately Wells' first fire call with his dad.
And you describe in this book the moment when he got that red bandana that we heard President Obama talking about earlier. Tell us about that.
In most things, most matters of manhood, and I think a lot of sons can relate to this no matter their age, they look to their father as the example. And getting dressed for church one morning when Wells was 7 years old, he had a suit on and so did his father, Jeremy, but he saw that his dad had a pocket square in the breast pocket of his suit jacket and he wanted one as well. So Jefferson, his dad, went back to the bedroom to grab one, but then thought, I wonder if he's going to take that and blow his nose in it. Let me take a preemptive measure here and give him something else to blow his nose in case that moment arises during church. And he gave him a red bandana. Wells put it in his back pocket, and essentially he kept it there for the rest of his life. He wore it underneath helmets when he played sports, wrapped around his head. He wrapped it around different parts of, let's say, hockey sticks and lacrosse sticks. He even had it in his back pocket when he wore suits to work.
And did you have a sense of why it was so important to him that he wore it for so long?
I think the answer there is just very simple, Jeremy, because his father gave it to him. Simple as that.
We're speaking with Tom Rinaldi, whose new book is The Red Bandana, A Life, A Choice, A Legacy. And it's all about Wells Crowther, who became famous because of what happened on 9/11. So tell us what happened on September 11th, 2001.
Like the more than 14,000 people that came to work in the towers that day, Wells showed up for a day at work at Sandler O'Neill on the 104th floor of the South Tower. He'd been working there a little under 2 years, had just made the move to the trading desk. The South Tower, to remind those who I'm sure will remember, was the second tower to be hit. He remained in the building after the North Tower was hit. That was partially the instruction of the Port Authority, which came across the PA. But many in his office also remained. But ultimately, after the second plane hit, he left his mother a message. And then he made his way down the only functional stairwell left in the South Tower. He made his way down from 104 to the 78th floor, the Sky Lobby, which was where elevators left the lobby, went up as an exchange point, if you will, for people to take the more local elevators up to the highest floors of the tower. He saw a scene which is nearly indescribable, as many as 200 people who had been killed in an instant when the lower wing of Flight 175 burst through the 78th floor. And what he encountered there was fires and smoke and people who were terribly injured, and wrapping a red bandana around his face to keep his mouth and nose clear from the smoke and the acrid smell and everything else that was happening, Jeremy, he called out to people that he knew the way down. And a group followed him, including one woman, Ling Young. They walked down more than 10, then 15 flights, then 17 flights of stairs. At one point, Ling Young looked back at him, Jeremy, and saw that he was carrying a woman across his back while he walked down those flights. They got to 61, where the air had cleared. He put the woman down on the stairwell, looked at Young, and issued one sentence: "I'm going back up." They continued down. The woman did not, although Young implored her to go. Young ultimately would make it out to safety, which is a remarkable story in and of itself. Crowther went back up, led a second group, including a woman named Judy Ween, down those flights of stairs. He ultimately made it all the way down to the lobby, but did not leave, Jeremy. As someone with firefighting experience, he went to the command post and Assistant Chief Donald Burns and began to download all the information, all that he had seen, to try to let firefighters who were still making their way up know what they were going to encounter and how many needed help on 78. And ultimately, when the towers collapsed, his remains would be found months later, surrounded by the remains of other firefighters.
Do you think, after looking into this, that he knew that he wasn't going to make it out of there alive?
It's a question that we'll never have an answer to. What we do know is that he was 75 feet away from the rest of his life. But he didn't make that walk, which would have taken a handful of seconds. Instead, he stayed to help.
When President Obama spoke at the dedication of the National 9/11 Memorial and Museum in May of 2014, Ling Young, who you just mentioned, was there. The Wells family was there. This is his mother, Allison. Let's listen.
It is our greatest hope that when people come here and see Wells's red bandana, they will remember how people helped each other that day. And we hope that they will be inspired to do the same, in ways both big and small. This is the true legacy of September 11th.
How did the people who he saved talk about him to you?
Ling Young accompanied Allison Crowther that day. That was such a difficult day for her, Jeremy. She had never returned to Ground Zero. And she did so out of tribute to Wells and out of love and connection to the Crowther family. Ling Young speaks about Wells Crowther in a way that is so deeply moving. Someone who owes her life to a young man and who was heartbroken when she did find out his identity and knows simultaneously, Jeremy, that she could never thank him in person. And it's very similar for Judy Ween, another woman who he saved. Judy is really never spoken about what's happened beyond the first few days. Her husband handles all of the interview requests, and we spoke to her husband, Jerry Sussman. And as he relates it, they essentially say the same thing. They're deeply indebted, but also heartbroken. And it's wonderful to see how these families have all connected with the Crowthers and still do very deeply to this day.
Tom Rinaldi, the situation that Wells was in was something that nobody can prepare for. Nobody knows if that's ever going to happen. As you were looking into his life, did you ever think about what you would have done if you had been in that situation?
Countless times. I started to think of all the people in my life. How many who I know would have made this choice? Then within that, there's a second calculus. How would my age affect that? If I would for one moment have that kind of courage, would I still have it if I had children, if I were married, if I had more people dependent upon me in my life? All of those things, which I would suggest, never went through Wells Crowther's mind. Obviously, pure conjecture here on my part from having studied his life and then written a book about it. But I think you develop a core and a character that is revealed in a situation of the ultimate stakes. And in this case, this is the decision that he made.
That's Tom Rinaldi talking about Wells Crowther, the subject of his book, The Red Bandana, A Life, A Choice, A Legacy. We spoke last year.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Have you tried to get a teenager to put down their devices? This summer, students at Washington Latin Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. were challenged to do just that. Their principal offered $100 to every student who successfully avoided cell phones, televisions, and video games for 11 consecutive Tuesdays. Just Tuesday. 70 of the 160 students offered the No Tech Tuesday Challenge tried it. Just 36 successfully completed it. Here's a taste of how it went.
My name is Liza Catania, and I'm in eighth grade. It was really hard when I was just in my house, and I had like a do-nothing day. I didn't really know what to do because normally I'd be like, I'd call my friends and ask if they wanted to like hang out or something like that, but I couldn't. I would have to either use the landline, which is like ancient. I would close my eyes and ask my mom to look on my phone and give me the number of one of my friends, and then I would use this landline and call my friends, and normally, like, I almost never got anyone because they didn't know the number, so they thought I was, like, a telemarketer.
My name is Zoe Edelman. I am in ninth grade. When I was making plans with my friends, my parents would be like, ha-ha, this reminds me of when I was a kid and we had to make plans the old-fashioned way. I would make sure my activities with my friends, like when I hung out with my friends, weren't inside the house. Like they were like, we're going somewhere new and fun, like a museum.
My name is Lydia Moore, and I'm a freshman at Washington Latin. I actually had to set a reminder on my phone for Monday nights that the next day was Techless Tuesday, which I thought was interesting that I can't even remember what day of the week it is on my own anymore. I'm honestly surprised that 36 people completed it and that 70 even tried to begin with.
My name is Logan Blair, and I'm in eighth grade. I knew I wasn't going to complete it, and I ended up not. I was at a basketball game with my friends, and so they were playing, and everybody was on the phone and everything. I had no one to talk to. No one was conversing. So I kind of reached in my backpack, took out my phone, and checked everything. And it was, I felt disappointed in myself, actually. A friend of mine dropped out a good week into it. I was like, come on, man. And because they stranded me doing it as well, and so...
My name is Luca Campanovo. I'm in eighth grade now, and I go to Washington Latin Public Charter School. No Tech Tuesday has, like, affected me in a way that, like, my brain doesn't automatically think, I'm bored, oh, I'll just play Xbox or I'll get on my phone. So, like, I actually feel like I'm doing other things a lot more. Like, there's this one time, it was Tuesday, I was coming back from New Jersey with my family, and I talked with my parents for, like, 4 hours. I actually learned a lot about them, like, how they met and things like that. It made me feel, like, better, I guess.
Imagine that. Some of the students who took the No Tech Tuesday challenge at Washington Latin Public Charter School, a story produced by WAMU's Kate McGee. And this note, we'll soon be looking at the two sides of the debate over cell phones in schools. Some schools trying to ban them, some encouraging them. Where do you stand? We'd love to hear from you, maybe include you in our story at hereandnow.org. And of course, Hurricanes Irma and Harvey have upset the school year for millions of students across Florida and Texas. Some of Houston's schools reopened today. The school district estimates Harvey did $700 million in damages to schools across that state. Schools in many parts of Florida are, of course, closed today. In the Florida Keys, the chain of island towns where Hurricane Irma first made landfall yesterday, officials in Monroe County say anxiety is running high because there's no fuel, electricity, running water, or cell phone service. Crews that can get to parts of the island chain are starting to go house to house to search for victims. WLRN's Nancy Klingener is in Key West, the southernmost point in the Keys. So, Nancy, the storm's moved on. It's flooding up in Jacksonville in the north of the state. How would you assess things in the south where you are?
Well, the damage in Key West is thankfully, I don't want to say minor because there's a lot of trees down. A couple of those trees have fallen on houses. A lot of people got water in their houses. It's no joke, but I'm much more concerned about areas up the Keys where they took a much more direct hit from that very powerful storm. And we're pretty much cut off information-wise. We don't have power. We don't have Wi-Fi. I'm talking to you right now on an old landline and trying to get information from up the road. But like I said, we're sort of cut off down here and without power and
right.
even without much water.
Well, what are some of the places you're thinking about?
Marathon, the community in the Middle Keys, is really my primary concern because I don't know anybody who's heard from them yet. Although, like I said, we are not in a real great information gathering spot down here at the moment.
Well, it's funny. Let me tell you some of the things we're hearing. You know, water lapping at the steps of Marathon High, which is one of the few shelters. And we're hearing that the roof was actually torn off the building in Marathon where some of the, you know, the state's best weather researchers went to study the storm. They lost a roof there. So, yeah, there's some damage there.
Yeah, the storm went across on Cudjoe Key, which is about 20 miles up the road from Key West, and then the area 30 to 50 miles just east of that would carry the worst winds of the storm, and that would put it right on squarely on Marathon. So that's pretty scary for them.
Well, and according to the Miami Herald, over the weekend, you know, as you're speaking of the damage to the middle and upper Keys, Monroe County emergency managers hinted that they feared there could be fatalities. So, you know, a big issue there. And talk about the overall issue with the Keys. These small passages that they have to the north to the mainland, we understand some of these bridges also carry water for the Keys.
There's a water pipeline that runs underneath the bridge, and that is our supply of fresh water, which is pumped up on the mainland and sent down along the Keys. So, yeah, that's our water supply.
Yeah. So how are people cut off where you are? How are they holding up?
They're okay. I mean, people here feel really grateful that, you know, we didn't suffer a catastrophic hit like Marathon may have. Mm-hmm. And they're just kind of starting to clear out debris and figure out their own personal water and food supplies and being able to power up their devices from inverters on their cars, which is what I'm doing mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about. and any other, you know, fuel for chainsaws and other power tools you would need to clean up. You know, my yard is basically an impenetrable forest of downed trees, none of which really fell on my house, thank goodness.
Thank goodness.
But, you know, we'll have to clean that out. But that seems, like I said, pretty minor compared to people who may have lost their homes and even their lives.
Yeah, here's a fellow talking from Summerlin Key, which was in the eye wall, that you know, the edge of the eye. He said his home was torn to pieces. He saw roofs ripped off other homes. He lost his van. He lost everything. So these reports are going to start trickling in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Is there still a curfew there?
I hear from my folks on the mainland that we have a dusk to dawn curfew in the entire Keys. That would make sense because at least here in Key West, the streets are full of downed trees and trying to get around is difficult and probably a little bit dangerous. And there's some folks wandering around that you don't know who they are or what they're doing there, and that's a little scary, too. So it would make perfect sense. The problem is I don't know how they would let people know that there's a dusk to dawn curfew here in Key West. I mean, normally you'd think, okay, if there's no radio, then they would drive down the streets broadcasting it, but they can't even really do that because the streets aren't passable.
Right. So. Well, but we understand that there are some workers with chainsaws in Key West, you know, at least clearing there. They've gotten that far.
Yep.
Well, we understand some military crews might get some airdrops.
Yeah, we have a naval air station on Boca Chica Key, which is about 8 miles up the road from Key West. And our city manager here in Key West is the former commanding officer of that naval air station, which is probably going to come in handy right now.
Yeah.
And so I would not be at all surprised that they'd be coordinating the relief efforts that way.
And for those thinking, okay, well, they can't drive, but they have their boats, the water, I'm sure, is filled with debris.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good idea right now to try to approach the Keys by boat until the Coast Guard gives the all clear for that.
Yeah. Well, WLRN's Nancy Klingener, you still, I'm sure, you know, with all these issues, are grateful.
Very, very, very grateful that I had a safe place to ride out this storm and that Key West seems to have been spared the worst of it, and very, very concerned for the other parts of the Keys that it appears we're not.
Yeah. Nancy, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
In advance of Irma, we saw videos of flamingos at Busch Gardens in Tampa being marched to safety. Today, the park reports all their animals are safe. There was that heartwarming story of the manatees, those big lugs being rescued after they were stranded when Irma sucked the water out of Sarasota Bay. There are pictures of alligators wandering streets. Joe Wasilewski is in Homestead, Florida. He survived Hurricane Andrew there in 1992 and stayed to face Irma because he's a herpetologist with more than 150 animals that he takes to lectures and rents out to TV shows. Joe, you stayed behind for them. How'd they fare?
Everybody fared well. My property didn't fare well, but the people in the wildlife, all my animals did.
How about your property? What happened?
I have a fairly large compound with a few acres, and trees are down all over it. It's going to take me weeks to move this amount of downed vegetation.
Yeah, well, but as you said, the what are they? Alligators, snakes, lizards? Tell us what's there.
I'm a herpetologist which studies reptiles and amphibians, and I have everything from alligators and crocodiles to iguanas and even a Galapagos tortoise who did well during the storm.
Well, and what if they had? I mean, some people wonder about having these collections of animals in areas that are subject to huge storms. We know during Harvey, there was an alligator rescue area. The waters were rising. People had to be in boats around the refuge area with guns just in case these alligators that they'd saved escaped. We know how there are pythons, more pythons in the Everglades. People, of course, abandoned their pythons there, which is wrong. But there was also a python breeding facility. People think that those pythons got into the Everglades during Andrew. Do you worry about, you know, having these collections?
Well, thanks to Andrew, the Game Commission has adopted new rules for keeping these animals. And in order to do so, you have to submit a hurricane plan. An officer comes out and inspects your property as to your evacuation or ability to ride out a storm along with your animals to keep yourself and them safe.
Yeah, which is what you did. You put them in boxes and crates?
Yes, I did, and locked up. The venomous snakes and the big pythons all were double bagged and locked. And, you know, even though it's a requirement, it makes common sense, and I would do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, you're reminding us of a man that we met outside Tampa once a few years ago who has a circus animal refuge on his property, lions. Are you kind of, you in the animal world, are you in touch with each other in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, there's places. I got a guy right down the block from me that has wolves, and I know a half a dozen people that have tigers and things like that. So, yeah, there's a lot of it down here. And, in fact, I do distinctly remember after Hurricane Andrew tracking a lion in the Everglades.
That's right.
Full-grown, yeah. So you just brought goosebumps to me from that memory.
Right. And just your thoughts, too, having been in Andrew and Irma. Any thoughts of leaving?
Hell no. No, this is home. This is where we're going to stay.
By the way, some would say you risked your own life staying back with them. Why are they that important?
They're more than, you know, wildlife. To me, they're my living. I've worked with them and I've cared for them since I can remember my earliest memory. So I just, they're something that is way too close to my heart.
Yeah. Well, that's Joel Wasilewski, a herpetologist in Homestead, Florida. More than 150 animals at his home. Alligator snakes, lizards, venomous snakes, too. Joe, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
As we continue to follow Irma, we are also monitoring other news, including from Hollywood, which just had the worst summer at the U.S. box office in more than 10 years. The summer produced $3.8 billion in ticket sales, down around 15% from last summer, with films like these.
Welcome to Baywatch. Our team is the elite of the elite.
I'm looking for a pirate, Captain Jack Sparrow.
Well, today is your lucky day. Because I just happen to be Captain Jack Sparrow.
They made a pact. A pact that would unleash darkness itself.
So what happens now?
You know what happens now. You're quickly becoming a legend.
Clips there from Baywatch, the latest installment of Pirates of the Caribbean, The Mummy, and King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. If you didn't see any of them, that's the problem. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us as he does each Monday from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
And let's start with something that people in the movie industry have complained about, which is they believe that websites like Rotten Tomatoes are the problem, that it makes it really hard for movies to succeed. Is that the case?
Yes, blame the critics. It was a terrible summer at the box office, and there were a lot of blockbuster films with bad reviews and therefore low Rotten Tomatoes ratings. You heard from Baywatch, Pirates, The Mummy, King Arthur. So Hollywood executives and journalists, too, are making, I guess, an obvious connection to them, that the latter is causing the former, that because Rotten Tomato aggregate ratings are so easy to see, it's easier for audiences who are sort of iffy on a film to say, oh, well, if it's below 50%, I'm not going to see it. If it's certified fresh, then I'll see it. I did some research on this, or at least consulted other people who did more empirical research on this. And the problem is that it's just really, really difficult to prove that Rotten Tomatoes alone is determinative of box office. Because, yes, of course, you can find busts like King Arthur that got bad reviews, or movies like Baby Driver that were clearly buoyed by strong Rotten Tomatoes numbers. But there are always exceptions. The Emoji Movie was one of the worst reviewed movies in recent memory, and it had a really strong opening. And then the movie Detroit struggled despite great reviews. And so, you know, I looked at this and I came down on the idea that, you know, the concept that criticism moves audiences at the margins but isn't really determinative, that's always been true. So it's difficult to say that the thing that has changed is Rotten Tomatoes.
You know, I have to admit I make my decisions on movies in part based on Rotten Tomatoes. And I did it earlier this year with the film Get Out, which had an unbelievably good rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and it was. It lived up to it, and so therefore, I guess I'll continue to trust Rotten Tomatoes. But the other thing that may be at play here that you've been writing about is the cost of these films, that they have gotten so expensive that maybe they just don't make a lot of economic sense.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's definitely happened is that movies are no longer the singular entertainment experience of America. And so as Americans have seen fewer and fewer movies each year, Hollywood has responded to this economic crisis by doing something kind of interesting, by employing what some economists call a blockbuster strategy. That is, you spend more and more money on fewer and fewer films. And what happens when you employ this strategy is that one should expect there to be more huge hits and more huge flops. So if you think back over the last few years, it seems like every single year we always hear about these famous flops, whether it's, you know, John Carter or a new Pirates of the Caribbean that didn't do well or a new Transformers film that flopped. That is the inevitable result of a Hollywood strategy of spending more on fewer films. It means you're concentrating your economic bets on fewer outcomes. And that means more huge hits and more huge flops. But we just saw after a summer of flops, the movie based on the Stephen King novel, had the largest horror opening in movie history, one of the largest September openings ever. So once again, right after this summer from hell, the horror season opens with a huge hit.
Well, and part of the problem for Hollywood has to be the fact that we're in a golden age of television right now with so many incredible shows on Netflix and Amazon and HBO and other places. And it's just, why go to the movies if you can have that experience at home?
That's exactly right. In the middle of the 20th century, almost half the country went to the movies every single weekend. In the 1940s, Americans bought on average 35 to 40 movie tickets a year. Now we buy less than four. All right? That means that the per capita movie economy is one-tenth of what it used to be 70 years ago. So clearly a lot has changed. We're living in the middle of a content bubble that is popping up everywhere. It is a content bubble in television with Netflix and Hulu and HBO Go. It's a content bubble on our smartphones with everything you can see on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. There is so much for movies to compete with. And as a result, I think you have a lot of people in Hollywood feeling like you have to present audiences with a $200 million flick in order to lasso them into the cinema.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in an association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.